Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dan Bornstein, columnist and editorial writer for the Contra Costa Times and Oakland Tribune, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight's program will focus on the issue of public employee pensions and whether pension reform can help relieve California's economic woes. Before we get started with our panelists, I want to help folks with a very simple pension primer. What we're going to be talking about are the pensions that are provided for workers in state and local government in California. Under these pension programs, when a worker retires, she receives a set amount each year for the rest of her life. The amount is usually adjusted annually for inflation. The amount the worker initially receives is based on her final salary, the number of years she worked, and her age at retirement. Starting back in 1999, the formulas were changed to increase the benefits. The increased costs of those benefits are a contributing factor to the current strain on the pension system. Now let's look at the other side. To pay for those benefits, public employers, better known as the government, or more accurately, the taxpayers, make payments to the pension system. In many cases, the employees also make a contribution. In many cases, however, they do not. The idea is that the contributions each year from the employer, and in the cases when the employee contributes as well, will earn enough interest through investments so that there will be enough money in the system to pay the pensions when those workers retire. This, of course, assumes that those investments make money rather than losing money, as they did in a big way in 2008. That market downturn is another big contributing factor to the current strain on the pension system. How bad is our problem today? CalPERS, the state's largest pension system, had about $227 billion in assets as of yesterday. The problem is that only about 65 to 70% of the amount they should have is covered with that money. Put another way, the system is about $115 billion short. CalPERS is but one of many public employee pension systems across the state, most of which face similar huge deficits. What does all this mean? In the future, state and local taxpayers, and probably public employees, will have to pay more and more into the pension system to make up for that shortfall. That will mean less money to hire public employees, and that will mean less money available for public services, from social services to road maintenance to libraries to, well, just about any public service you can think of. The question today is, how do we get out of this mess? For that, I want to introduce our panelists. To my immediate left is John Kupal, president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. John, who is a lawyer, has argued numerous tax cases before the courts. He's also chairman of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Foundation, which provides funding for taxpayer rights, litigation, and educational studies. Sitting next to him is Roxanne Sanchez, who is president of the Service Employees International Union Local 1021. Roxanne was the president of SEIU BART chapter and sat on the executive board of the Service Employees International Union Local 790 from 2002 to 2007. She has worked in the private, public, and nonprofit sectors. And to my far left is Joe Nation, who is director of the Graduate Public Policy Practicum at Stanford University. From 2000 to 2006, Joe served in the California State Assembly. Please welcome our panelists. Before we start breaking down the numbers and the facts, what I want to do is sort of get a little bit of the personal perspective from the two sides, from Roxanne and from John. And I want to start with Roxanne for a moment. Roxanne, can you just tell us a little bit about how workers see this problem?
So, first of all, although I hold a title in my union, I'd like the audience to know that I've been a worker all my life, and I'm now on full release for the last 9-10 months as a representative of the union. So I'm right from the ranks. I'm right for the trenches. And the way we feel about it is, and I'll just give you some statistics here. Last year in 2011, but in 2009, my coworkers in the city and county of San Francisco reduced their earnings and wages through concessions by $150 million. That's several hundreds of dollars per month. This was to deal with the economic downturn, the meltdown of 2008. That following year, in the spring of 2010, workers again agreed to lower their earnings by $24 million over 2 years. So you think about the San Francisco City and County workers, and they have lost earnings close to $500 million over the next 3 years. On top of that, we've had severe job cuts. The job cuts now puts the city of San Francisco in the lowest level ever at 49.7% of the total expenditures goes to labor. So you could see that the burden on the working class through this economic downturn has been severe. And remember, this came off of another downturn in 2001. So how workers are looking at it is we're anxious. We're concerned. The pensions that he spoke about from workers that have already retired are modest, about $2,100 a month. Children are moving back into our houses. We're taking care of our parents. Our costs are going up. Everything is more expensive. And that's sort of the backdrop. On top of that, millions of Americans have lost their retirement because of the meltdown of the economy, their life savings, and their 401ks. Workers are panicked. And what I'm looking for, and hopefully in this discussion and further ones that will go on and on and on, I'm sure, is that we all come together and rebuild our country from where it has been taken.
John, anxious, concerned, panicked workers, tell us a little bit about how taxpayers are seeing this picture.
I think those adjectives apply to taxpayers as well. I think the difference is there is a perception, people agree with it or not, that the public sector is far more protected against some of the economic vagaries in today's society than our taxpayers. State employment, just one example, state employment actually has gone up in the last couple of years. At the same time, California's unemployment is 12.5%. There's a perception on the part of the taxpaying community that the public sector has not borne its share fair of the pain. And we can argue about whether or not that's a fair assessment or not. I will say right off the bat that of my organization, which got its start with Proposition 13, that meant many, many of our members are either retired or active public employees, and they want to keep their homes. So there is this tension, Dan, between and I think everybody wants the same thing. We want good public service, and we want fair compensation. But there is a perception right now that in California, the compensation levels are way out of whack, both with respect to other public sector groups across the country and certainly within the private sector here in California. So I think that is the problem that we're facing, is a perception which we believe is grounded in large part in reality, that there is a disparity between how much of a haircut the public sector has taken relative to the private sector. Another problem we see, of course, is some of the abuses in the pension system, the pension spiking. We all know about the City of Bell situation. And certainly the City of Bell was a little bit of an outlier, but some of those same problems are a little bit endemic across California, and they need to be addressed in a major way.
Joe, you're the academic here, the former politician.
Now I'm an academic.
Are you still a politician? which side here has the right reality?
Well, as a politician, I'll say they're both right. but I think that Let me pose the question this way. I think the question that that both sides have to ask and answer is the system healthy? Is the system sustainable? Is the pension system something that we can count on 5, 10, 20 years down the road? And I think there's a growing recognition on both sides of this discussion that the system is not, that the system is in trouble. Then I think you have to get to that second level or second layer of questions where you start talking about benefits, you talk about portfolios, investments, governance, and so forth. But the first question has to be, will the system survive? And of course, you know the work that we've done at Stanford suggests that the shortfall at the state level and municipal level combined could be as much as about $700 billion.
Statewide.
To put that into perspective, the general fund budget for this next year request from Governor Brown is $84 billion. So $84 billion, potential shortfall of $700 billion. Houston, we have a problem.
Why is it not healthy as you see it?
Well, I think the primary reason is because, as you referenced, in 1999, there was a bill passed, Senate Bill 400, that was actually debated on the floor of the Assembly. For the record, I wasn't there. I didn't vote for it. But I will tell you, had I been there as a Democrat, I probably would have voted for it along with every other Democrat. Every Democrat voted for the bill, and virtually every Republican voted for the bill. And they voted 113 collectively in the two houses to zero, essentially, 113 to 7, for this significant expansion in benefits. And they did it on the Assembly side after 90 seconds of debate. Literally, it was an issuance of about the equivalent of about $200 billion in future debt for the state of California, and there was 90 seconds of debate. So there are benefit issues that have to be discussed. There are also adequacy of funding issues, and I think the reason that we are in the hole we're in right now is in part because the pension funds, the pension systems, tend to overstate their expected returns to the market and undervalue their liabilities. For example, CalPERS continues to insist that they will earn 7.75% per year. Despite what's happened the last few years, now they've had, the last year has been pretty good, but 7.75% per year in the face of 10 years of about 3% is probably too optimistic. And when you make that assumption, then you understate those liabilities, and then you end up with, as you said, a $150, $200, whatever billion shortfall.
So, Roxanne, what happens when you go back to your members and say, we're concerned? Do they understand this? Or, how do they see it? And how do you see it?
So one of the reasons that we ran a group of working people to these positions in their union is to get involved in the discussion and the debate from our experience, because the perceptions just aren't our reality. Let me just say something about pension funds, though, because in this economic meltdown that happened in 2008, we talk about pensions as almost like they're part or the problem or created the problem, but I want to look at historically what impact pensions and pension funds have had on the economy. If we look at the period between 1990 and 2002, pension funds supplied about 44% of the new venture capitals. That means that and endowments and foundations were the second largest, with about 17%, and then insurance companies and financial companies at about 16%. So if you look at that investment in venture capital, you have to look at the fact that pension funds fueled the growth and the development of small companies and new products and technologies for over a decade. That's the contribution that these pension funds have done for our economy.
You're talking about the money that they had in their funds.
The money that we
while
put.
That is supposed to be making money for the pensioners.
Yes.
And how you invested in the market.
That's correct. Want to look at the fact that over a decade, these pension funds created wealth, tremendous wealth. They created economic opportunity, and they created thousands of jobs. Now, The economy is a mess, and pension funds are part of the economy, and obviously they're affected. But that doesn't mean that the pension funds are the problem. Now, are there concerns and are there problems, and do we have to face them, and do we have to address them and correct them? Yes, but in the wider content of the economic downturn, the reform has to be broader than pension, because that won't work. It has to be a broader financial reform.
John, how do you see that?
Well, you know,
and then we'll get to the specifics of pension.
It relates to the pension funds, that's right. The major pension funds have invested a lot, PERS, STERS, and the counties. But the question is, have they invested wisely, and have they made the decisions based on the interests of their members, or is there some? Oftentimes, some of these investments are made with political motivations, and some of the investments of PERS have been horrible. Now, part of the problem that taxpayers see is that when bad decisions are made, both the pension system knows that the taxpayers are there to make up the shortfall. You always have the taxpayers in a defined benefit program constitutionally mandated to make up the difference if PERS and STERS goes belly up, and that's what we're seeing right now. You know, one of the things, and by the way, we're all in favor of public employees getting a really good pension, but we believe that the ultimate answer is to have those pension benefits granted in the form of defined contribution, like 401ks, and not in these defined benefits. Now, people say, well, 401ks are risky. Well, if each individual employee owned their own 401k, they could accept whatever investments and accept whatever risk tolerance they wanted. For example, you could have a 401k that invested in nothing but treasury bills that would be absolutely guaranteed not to lose money. Now, would you get the 12% return? No, but perhaps you shouldn't if the risk isn't – I mean, you know, why have the taxpayers – here's the question. Why have taxpayers assume the risk of losses of their own retirement funds, but also assume the risk of the losses, potential losses, of the public employees who are guaranteed a guaranteed rate of return? And that's the disparity. And we believe that the ultimate answer is a shift to very generous defined contribution plans that would take away some of the, quite frankly, the political machinations of these public employee retirement funds who have oftentimes not acted in the best interests of either their members or the taxpaying public.
Okay, Joe and I are going to have a little exchange now to try and do a little education to step back here for a second, because you guys have raised – we're going to talk about solutions in a few minutes, but let's help people understand the way this works. There are basically two different types of retirement funds in general terms, right? Joe, talk about the difference between what a defined benefit is and a defined contribution. We know a defined benefit as a typical pension program. We think of a defined contribution. Most people in the private sector think of it as a 401k.
Right.
Can you explain the difference?
Sure. Most people have 401ks. At Stanford, I have a 403b, roughly the same. And every month I put a little bit of money in, and Stanford actually has a pretty generous match. They'll match up to 6%, which these days is significant. And if the market performs well and my investments do relatively well, then someday when I retire, then I'll be comfortable. That's a defined contribution plan. A defined benefit plan is one where the employee is guaranteed that income regardless of what happens. So it doesn't matter if the Dow Jones goes from almost 12,000 a day down to 6,000. It doesn't matter if real estate values go from tens of billions to 3 billion. Those employees still get that fairly high rate of return and that high benefit level. And so a typical plan might be in the public sector. And for the record, my younger brother is a firefighter, a paramedic. If you're a public safety member in California, usually you get something that's called 3% at 50, which means you can retire with 3% of your salary times the year of service at age 50. So if you start at age 20 and you work 30 years, you retire with 90% of your salary at age 50. that's pretty generous. And in particular, it's generous with a lot of people who, you know, who spike it. That's not the norm. That's not the norm, but that's one of the problems. Yeah, so essentially that's the difference between the two.
I want people to understand a key difference in all of this, and that's the risk factor here, okay? And it's an important one to understand. The advantage of a defined benefit plan, that is a pension plan, is there's security for the employee. They never have to worry about how much they're going to get in retirement because the amount is guaranteed. The advantage to defined contribution is that there's no risk to the employer. The risk falls on the employee if the market goes south. We're talking tonight about defined benefit plans primarily, but we're going to look at, you know, one of the options discussed is a defined contribution. A very important point, though, about a traditional pension plan, a defined benefit plan, which is important for folks to understand, is when you the employer, as we discussed earlier, the employer contributes to it, and often the employee contributes to it. And the idea is there should be enough money later down the line. However, if there is not enough money later down the line, the shortfall falls entirely to the employer. You don't go back and have the employee kick in. It all falls to the employer. Now, this is an ongoing process. So at any given time when there's a shortfall, and we talked about the shortfall with CalPERS, that shortfall will all be made up by taxpayers. It will not, that portion will not be split between employer and employee. I want you to understand it's a complicated process, but hopefully we can educate as we go along. So the question is, what are some of the options? And for what are some of the solutions? What I'd like you to do, Joe, is to put on the table options. And then I'd like Roxanne and John to, in a very, you know, quick response to each of these options in terms of their gut as to what they think of them. What are some of the options to make a defined benefit system work better?
Sure.
Or to fix this system in California?
Sure. The first thing that I think is really critical is that the pension fund managers and the actuaries need to change the assumptions that they employ. Currently, according to GASB rules, Government Accounting Standard Board's rules, pension fund managers say, well, if we're going to earn 7.75%, then we're going to discount our liabilities at 7.75%. And the math works out really nicely if they do that. But the problem with that is that, as you described, because these are guaranteed payments, you really have to value the liabilities at something different than that 7.75%. You have to value them at something probably much higher. And it's a somewhat esoteric argument among economists and actuaries, but if you were to do that and change the way they account for this and truly value those liabilities at what you should value them, then pension funds today would be horribly underfunded. In fact, the work that we've done suggests that they are not 70 or 80% funded, but it's closer to 40 or 50% funded. They've got a dollar for every $2 that they owe.
And people should know, the work Joe has done on this is somewhat controversial. There is a debate as to what the proper rate of return is.
Not among economists.
Not among economists. Okay.
actuaries and economists, yeah, there okay. is. So that's one thing.
Let's take that option before we confuse people with other things.
Okay.
This is a political question, however, because if you reduce the assumed rate of return, that means more. Both the employer and the employee would have to kick in more going into the system. So, Roxanne, how are your members going to feel if they're asked to kick in more if the rate of return, the assumed rate of returns are reduced?
Well, like all working people right now that are strapped for money. I mean, let's look at the San Lorenzo classified school workers. who get between $11.55 and $29 an hour and contribute 7% of their total wages to their pension. Let's look at the jurisdictions where they're already paying over $800 a month for their pensions. But I want to say something, because here's the problem. Look how we talk about things. We say we're talking about significant problems and significant issues, but we're not looking at the fact that the significant problem is the drop in investment return. It means that the significant problem is that our country's economy, our economic system, is in shambles. It's in total disarray. It's at the brink of disaster. Now, let's take a look at that for just a second, because if you think this financial crisis, and we've all been watching it, it was a huge Ponzi scheme. And it was engineered by Wall Street investors and executive directors and all your bankers. And your economic institutions supported this Ponzi scheme, said, yeah, it's valid, it's going to work. So here's the problem. American workers like ourselves, we run into for these positions. I'm standing in front of you very modestly, because this is not really what I do for a living. I fix things and do other kinds of stuff. But I'm telling you that the real reform has to be much broader. You can tweak reform and take more out of our pockets, and we'll buy less and we'll suffer more, but that's not fixing our economy. Millions of Americans have already lost their retirement. Has that helped our economy and our society? So I'm all for fixing things. Trust me, we bargain contracts every 3 to 4 years, and we have to deal with the constraints of the economy, be realistic. But this is not the way to look at fixing a problem that's facing all Americans. We need to look at a retirement system, whether it's our system or Social Security, that gives us what we require and what we've worked for all our lives, which is some financial protection. Our financial holdings as working people is very modest. I own a little house in San Leandro. I don't own it, but I have it. I was telling John here, $4,000 a year in taxes. I mean, we talk about taxpayers and public. I'm a taxpayer. 25% of my wages are taxed. I'm a worker. Right now I make $18.62 an hour. Come on. Our problem in this country is big. Is this part of a problem? I'm sure it is. Are there fixes that we have to look at? I'm sure there are. But if we look at them as a tangent off the line, we're not going to fix anything. We're just going to impoverish more workers.
I want to let John respond to that and to address the rate of return issue.
Yeah, I'll just talk about the rate of return issue. It's a huge problem. There are some very bright economists and investors who believe we're going to have a huge double-dip recession, plunge right back into depression. They're looking at all the debt load, and we've got other economists who think we're on the urge of another recovery. And they're all brilliant people. We don't know, and that's why when you try to determine rates of return, it is so difficult. The problem is when we're in a boom cycle, you have a horrible situation, and that is you've got a public employee fund, which is a ton of cash. It's got an excess cash in within arm's reach of politicians. And what happens? What happens? The public employee labor unions figure out a way to say it's so overfunded right now, we can bump up benefits. And there were people who said back when Senate Bill 400 that you can't do this. This is one-time money. And but you're right. Most of them voted for it, I mean, including Republicans. They shouldn't have. But the problem is there was this pot of money, and everybody thought it was a free lunch. And that is the problem with trying to determine rates of return. And I know we're not supposed to talk about solutions, but going over to the defined contribution plan takes care of that problem.
Joe, go ahead and comment, and then what is the next thing we might consider?
Just one comment on that. The question is, should funds assume that they're going to get a 7.75% rate of return? They do that because they say, well, from 1982 until recently, that's what we got. Well, 1982 to until 1999 was the biggest market run-up in the history of the planet, right? And so I would suggest that a better metric to use would be to look at what the return to capital was in the 20th century. And in fact, if you look at the period from 1900 to 1999, those are not arbitrary years. I just picked the beginning and the end of the century. The return is about 6.15%. So if a fund said, we're expecting 6.15% from equity, from the capital markets, that's probably a reasonable number to use. However, in the case of defined benefits, as you pointed out, again, they're guaranteed, so you've got to actually take it down a little further to account for that risk.
Okay, so we actually had a question from a member from the audience, and I think you just answered it because they talked about CalPERS' past 30 years rate of return, and this is an important point. CalPERS will argue that over the last at least 20 years, they've essentially made that 7.75 assumed rate of return. What I hear you saying, Joe, is that's not the right horizon to be looking at.
And it's more than that. Even if CalPERS achieves the 7.75%, even if they hit their target, if you run something called Monte Carlo simulations where you essentially roll the dice over and over and over and over and over, and you say, what are the odds that they will actually meet their funding obligations over about the next 15 to 20 years? The odds of CalPERS actually meeting their obligations to pay all those pensions is about 1 in 4 or 1 in 5. So even if they hit that target, they're in trouble.
Okay, so what's the next solution?
Another issue I think has to do with investments, the type of investments. And I think there's probably pressure growing among pension fund managers to reach a little more, to be a little riskier, to say, you know what? In fact, someone, a senior official at CalPERS, was quoted fairly recently saying, we think we can achieve a higher rate of return by investing in overseas markets. And now, that may be the case, but I think people need to understand that if you chase 10 or 12%, the odds are that you're going to have a rate of return that may get you 10 or 12% one year, but it may get you minus 20% the next year. So I hope that what funds do is they frankly look at their portfolios and they say, because these are guaranteed payments we have to make, maybe we should invest a little more conservatively. I think that's certainly something that's open for discussion.
Roxanne and John, does that make sense?
Yeah,
more conservative investments.
I think what Joe's saying, and I also think what John says. I mean, there's truth in what all three of us are saying up here, all of us, and that's why it's important for us to work together, right? Not to be polarized and not to just come to the table with our sort of, you know, tunnel vision on. And so workers are open. I mean, I'm looking at you guys, and you've worked for a living too, so, and still do in most cases. So we are open to solving the problem. But I got to look at the fact that while we're talking about pension problems, consider this. I just mentioned that the banks, the Wall Street banks and the executives of Wall Street created this problem through this Ponzi scheme. But think about the fact that right now banks are recording record high profits, and they're again giving annual huge bonuses. So here you have a worker who's thinking, here's a crisis and the sky is falling and I'm going to have to take more out of my pocket, and I'm lucky if I can keep $10,000 in my savings account for my roof or a leak or a car that breaks or the kids who come and ask for money because their education costs went up or my mother's care. And now, you know, I'm saying, okay, well, what do I have to do as a worker? Okay, well, I'm going to have to sacrifice. Of course, I'm going to have to give. I'm going to have to rebuild my country. Of course. But then I hear on the other side of the world, and it's different.
Roxanne, I'm going to ask you something on this.
Okay. I just wanted to finish this thought. The point is that the way to get workers and to get people fixing a problem is so that without contradictions. If there aren't contradictions, if things start making sense, we can find solutions. But if we're fixing something here and watching something over there that doesn't make sense, how can we think this through? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I just wanted, would you agree, though, that this is more, this is not something that is within the control of this debate here? You know, I mean, we can't control Wall Street.
So I would argue this, that, and I'm urging everyone here, and as I do to my coworkers, and as I'm urging myself, that we should talk definitely about pension reform in context of a comprehensive financial reform in this country. And that, of course, we're going to have to do things up front regarding pensions, of course. Upfront as part of a comprehensive system. Not, well, we'll fix the banks later, but in part of how we're going to fix this country. Because I'm going to tell you, at 59 years old, I'll be 60 next year, I'm frightened about the fact, yeah, I'll be living on a fixed income for the rest of my life of $31,000 a year. And that's a scary thing. I have to pay off all my debts. I have to lower my overhead. I have to tell the kids, you can't come and ask me for loans or a little help here. You know.
Okay, but I want to stay with the specifics here. Okay, so John,
on the rate of return,
I
agree with what Joe said. I mean, they need to lower their sights. And also, and that cuts directly to the issues of governance, who sits on the boards of directors of PERS and STERS. If it's no slam on labor, but if it's labor dominated, they have a certain agenda with respect to their investment choices. And it may not be in the best interests of their members if the taxpayers weren't backing it up. But because the taxpayers are always backing it up, these pension boards can pursue a political agenda without fear of retribution from their members because the taxpayers are always there to back them up.
Okay, before we go to the next possible solution, I just wanted to take a moment to remind folks that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking about the growing debate surrounding public employee pensions and whether pension reform is one of the possible relief valves for California's economic woes. Our panelists are John Kupal, president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, Roxanne Sanchez, president of the Service Employees International Union, Local 1021, and Joe Nation, director of the Graduate Public Policy Practicum at Stanford University. And with that, Joe, I'd like you to the next possible solution, next sure. thing that we might do to help relieve some of this.
The next thing I think is probably, I mean, John touched on it, is the issue of governance, and I'll add transparency to that. Mm-hmm. And I'll illustrate it with a couple of stories. If you are on a board of supervisors in California and you negotiate a contract or a pension benefit for your rank and file workers, guess what? You get the same plan. So you've got a member of the board of supervisors who says, boy, this is pretty generous. Well, that's okay because I get the same plan. That's outrageous that we have a system where there's that sort of conflict of interest. So, and I do think there's some issues involving the boards of these of pension funds. I think there need to be minimum requirements for financial investments or experience and so forth, which just don't exist today. The other issue is transparency. Transparency is going to come whether the pension fund managers and the others like it or not. It's going to happen because people are paying attention to this. And they ought to just say, here's what we have invested. This is what we owe. If you need some information, I'll provide it to you. I will tell you that has not been the experience we had. The group of students that I managed this or supervised this last year who did this first CalPERS study actually went to CalPERS and they said, we would like these data from you. CalPERS blew them off. They then went back and they filed a Public Records Request Act, something you're very familiar with. Guess what? And by law, CalPERS has 10 days to respond. Guess what? They never responded. Completely ignored them again. Then a report came out and they responded.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
That's a problem.
What is driving that? You know, why is that?
I think there is a resistance to transparency. Because with the case of some funds, there have been some allegations. In fact, there have been some criminal indictments in some parts of the country about kickbacks to board members and so forth. And I think they simply want to hide those transactions. They very often say, well, we're not going to share with you what portfolios we have.
What's the politics, though, here? Let's be clear. What's the politics that's really going on with these pension boards?
The politics behind the pension boards, I think, are that people assume that if it's quiet and in the background, no one will notice. And for the pension funds at the end of their process, they, as you pointed out, they can simply come to the state of California and say, well, we didn't do as well as we thought we were going to do. Would you write us a check for $5 billion? That's the number this year.
Okay. Let me be blunter with the question we have from the audience. Somebody asked essentially, aren't these essentially boards that are usually run by elected officials and union officials, and the elected officials are beholden to the union officials for their election?
Yes.
Isn't there politics underlying this? You know,
there's no doubt there are politics underlying it, and there are typically, you know, the people who sit on the boards at the state level tend to be state officials. They tend to be Democrats. They tend to be very friendly towards public employee unions, and they have this very close relationship. And so there isn't the same sort of oversight as you might have from someone who has a different perspective. There is without a doubt a governance
issue. Roxanne, do you agree with that?
Well, I think workers feel left out of the loop, but I'll tell you what workers like. Workers believe in transparency. We believe in transparency. I don't think any of us like politics. I don't think workers like politics is partly why we ran. We're tired of politics. We want to fix things. We want to have a strong country. So there are things, I think, that definitely can be improved that would be in the interest of workers. I appreciate John's work. I mean, as a taxpayer, I mean, having someone always advocating for your interests as a taxpayer is something I appreciate, and I would look forward to having conversations with John. I think there is a solution out there. But it's got to address the economy. It's got to address all politics, the politics that got us into this mess when, you know, people looked the other way during this Ponzi scheme. It's got to address everything.
John, do you see the transparency that when you try and get information, do you have the transparency?
It's a huge issue, and Joe is absolutely right. You know, the Marcia Fritz with the California Foundation for Fiscal Responsibility has tried repeatedly to get information. She's filed the Public Records Act requests at the local level and the state level. And on five different occasions, she was represented by attorneys, our organization, with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. We've had to sue to get that information. And we went 4-for-4, winning all four cases. We did a request to San Diego. They refused. We sued them. We won. We're 5-for-5. The city of San Diego appeals because it doesn't want people to know who is making what and what deals are being made. The transparency is a huge issue, and it's all we hear from the pension funds is, never mind that man behind the curtain. Just go about your business. We're the experts here. We know what we're doing. Well, I'm sorry, that doesn't wash. And the transparency, Joe is absolutely right, is a major problem with the local funds and the state funds.
Joe, I want you to talk about two possible solutions now that are often talked about. One is increased contributions. Let's start there with increased contributions and what that means,
I don't think there's any doubt that there will have to be increased contributions from both workers and from employers. I mean, the hole that we are in is so deep that the question is just how much. Recently, some jurisdictions have begun to ask workers to contribute a little bit more. Most of the movement has been very slight. I'll give you a sense of the magnitude of these. In one city in Marin, where I live, workers are now contributing not 0% towards their pension, they're contributing 2%. The city is contributing about 20 to 25%.
I want to explain what he means by that, okay, what these percentages mean. The way pension contributions are generally measured is as a percentage of payroll. So if you pay $100, in his example he just gave, if you earn $100 in salary, an additional, the employee pays $2 towards their pension, and the employer kicks in another 28, did you say, in your example?
20-something.
And the range is everywhere from $20, $21. I've seen it all the way up to $70, 70% on the 70 cents on the dollar. Okay? So that when he talks about 2%, he's talking about 2% of payroll. When he talks about 28%, he's talking about 28% of payroll. I'm sorry.
Right.
So, I just want people to understand.
Right. So clearly there'll have to be some increases in contributions, likely from employers and from employees.
Okay. Roxanne, and we're going to start moving quickly now. Roxanne, is that something employees are willing to do?
That's something employees are doing. I mean, you have to realize that the shift of cost is always on the workers. So we've taken concessions consistently over the last decade. So the concessions that we're taking are in pay and benefits and pensions. We're furloughs. We're working with far less people, so our workload is far greater. So yeah, I mean, we are paying for it. There's no doubt about it. We're paying for it. But I got to ask you. Here's the thing, because you got to help me here. We watch TV, you know, like everybody else does, and we watched that a couple of weeks ago. There was almost, I would say it was a pretty lively debate regarding the wealthiest Americans have.
No, I want to stay.
No, but I just want to say, because this is important. You're asking working people to give more, and we do. We don't just give more from our earnings. We give more when we contribute to organizations and volunteer. But when you ask the wealthiest people to help pitch in and give and increase their taxes to what they used to be, not anything new.
So the example is,
if you want workers to keep giving, and we will, then everybody's got to give. That's the American way.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is that we need to increase revenues from other sources as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
Okay, and I want to give a little bit of background on the contribution rates from what Roxanne said. Just so folks understand, it really depends on the union. For CalPERS, generally, the accepted employee contribution rate is usually for miscellaneous employees 8% of payroll, if I'm correct, and 9% for public safety workers of payroll. The employer pays all the rest, generally. That is a generally accepted. That is the standard for CalPERS, for cities that are members of CalPERS, or for the state. What you find is across the state, however, it's all over the board. In many cases, the cities will pay the employee's share. And in some cases, I've seen even the reverse, when the employee pays a little bit of the employer's share. But generally, the range is everywhere from 0 up to 8 or 9%, generally. In Contra Costa here, there with the firefighters, for complex reasons that I've written about, the employees actually pay substantially more than that, but it was offset by past salary increases. So, John, more contributions?
Yeah, I would agree that that is one solution if we're staying within the defined benefit kind of program. Again, this kind of program has its inherent faults, but within the parameters of what we're discussing right now, yes, increased contributions are going to have to be part of the mix.
Okay. Joe, we're going to go right through this, and I'm trying to deal with some of the questions that I've gotten up here with the questions I'm asking here. The next thing I want you to talk about that is talked about a lot, two-tier. Explain quickly what it is and what its advantages and drawbacks are.
Sure. A two-tiered system would be one in which a current employee continues to receive the same salary, benefits, pension, et cetera, and a new employee would get a lesser salary, lesser pensions. On the November ballot, there were 9 measures around California that actually reduced benefits for public employees, 8 of the 9 passed. The only one that failed was the one in San Francisco. So communities are moving to reduce those benefits going forward. The question that a lot of people have is, do they reduce the benefits for people who are there now? Not people who are retired, but someone, say, who's been working 20 years and they've got another 10 years to go. Is there a change there? And there are a lot of folks who argue that you actually have to do that, to put that on the table to get rid of this problem because of the magnitude of it. But I mean, this issue of benefits is one that really has to be discussed at some point.
Okay, so let me ask you a quick question. Technically, if we went to a two-tier system everywhere, would we solve the problem?
No.
Why?
Because the numbers are so large, and because even if you hire someone today, and even if they have a reduced benefit, they're not going to retire for another 30 years. And so you really don't get much of a win, of a decrease in your obligations until that person retires.
So, okay, I mean, so in summary there with two-tier, the point here is that it is something that has to be done for future generations,
right,
but it's not going to give us any savings out of this hole for at least a couple of generations.
Correct. Okay. And there's some other things, too. I mean, for example, on the benefit side, there's I'll cite this story because it was in the New York Times. There was a police chief who was the police chief of San Rafael, retired at age 55 with a $175,000 pension. He then traveled for a couple of years, got bored, decided he'd be the police chief in Tiburon. He's now the police chief in Tiburon. He makes $146,000 a year there. So he's earning roughly $325,000 a year as the police chief of Tiburon. I think he's 59 years old. And he will be eligible for yet another pension in 3 years because he will
be... He must be in two different pension
systems. He's in two different pension systems. He was in an independent fund, the Marin Fund in San Rafael, and he'll be in CalPERS. Now I want to emphasize that is not the norm.
Okay, Roxanne.
But there are abuses that happen, and clearly those are the things that we have to clamp down on as well.
Roxanne, is labor willing to go along with two-tier?
Well, you know, you're asking me to speak for 54,000 workers,
okay,
and I will.
I will,
because that's my role. But okay. I got to tell you, it's that, again, workers have come to the table, and we're constantly giving of ourselves the two-tier. We've negotiated two-tier in many of our jurisdictions. But I caution you that this problem cannot be fixed on the backs of working people. And I believe that all Americans, like we did 30, 40 years ago when Americans had a true retirement plan, we have to look at how to give people a dignity as we age, especially because we are the largest population of aging people in our history.
I've heard labor folks complain about two-tier by saying essentially that what you have is two workers doing the same job side by side with two different pension plans. Is that a legitimate concern?
It is, and it's a disparity. It's lack of equity. It's a disparity of treatment. I got to tell you, I don't. Obviously, tonight we're not going to solve the problems of the pension or the problems of our economy. But what I'm trying to tell you, workers, we are trying to come to the table. We, not the bureaucrats, but we, the workers, are coming to the table, and we're saying, let's solve the problem. But you know what? We're sincere. We're going to give of ourselves, but we're going to ask everybody to give. And the wealthy are not going to be excluded. And the privileged are not going to be excluded. Everyone's going to have to. I just want to say a quote. Our country is at its best when we are all involved in acting in its best interest. That's our mantra, and
John,
that's our goal.
Two-tier.
Yeah, I think two-tier has got to be a big part of it. Theoretically, what Joe said, we don't get out of this without a second tier. Theoretically, if the fund performance just went bonkers, coupled with substantial economic growth in California, theoretically we get out of it. But I think you're right. It's a real long shot. So the second question is, yeah, second tier is definitely needed. But there is an open question as whether or not, as to that first tier, whether those pension benefits can be modified. There's an ongoing legal debate as the extent to which those benefits can be modified. If current workers were granted benefits they'd never bargained for, if there was
you're opening a different can.
Okay.
We're going to get there in a second.
Okay.
let's go real quickly, and we're going to go through this one real quickly. what John is talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but what John has started to talk about is the notion of modifying going forward the benefit accrual rate for existing employees. That's different from two-tier, which is for new employees. In other words, could you modify, as they do in the private sector, and say to employees, going forward, you're not going to earn benefits at as rich a rate. We're not going to change anything that you've already earned to date, but going forward. Joe, what is the problem with that? What is the obstacle there?
Well, the biggest problem is the legal challenge. I mean, the legal theory is that that's permissible or possible. It's not clear that that would uphold or withstand a legal challenge because people would argue that it's part of a contractual obligation that the city, county jurisdiction has. I've heard people argue both sides of it. I think the majority of folks who've looked at this believe that it would be a violation of the contract and therefore it would not be permitted.
It would be a violation of the contracts clauses of the state and federal constitutions.
Correct.
Counter argument to it. This is going to be an issue. We're not going to debate it here right now because we could have a whole session on it, but that is the crux of the debate. Does it or does it not violate the contracts clauses of the state and federal constitution? Okay, I want to ask, and Joe, I want you to sort of explain a little bit because I got an oodle of questions about it up here. And then I want both Roxanne and John to quickly comment on it, and that is the nuclear option, so to speak, bankruptcy.
Well, I've never liked the nuclear option for anything. I think what's better to do is something that Roxanne has sort of pointed to, and that is that, you know, we can fight over this, we can draw those battle lines, or we can sit down at a table and work this through. And I hope that that's what we're able to do. And if you have everyone at the table, and I think most people are reasonable at the end of the process, I think we can find that solution. The bankruptcy option, I know, look at the case of Valeo. Valeo declared bankruptcy. They have made virtually no changes to their pension plans. But what they've done is they've laid off about one-third of their police force. So if you call a cop in Vallejo today, they don't come for a long time unless it's life-threatening. That's the downside. So, the cops don't want that. You know, the public employees don't want that. City managers don't want that. Citizens don't want that. We would be far better off to find some way where everyone gives a little bit as opposed to going with a nuclear
option. Roxanne or John, do either of you see bankruptcy as a viable or a good alternative?
Yeah. Yes. I think it was appropriate in Vallejo. I mean, if your liabilities far exceed your assets and there's just no way out for a municipal corporation, bankruptcy should be an option. And this is one area where the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association was in agreement with the California League of Cities, who wanted to preserve their ability to declare bankruptcy on behalf of their members for situations like Vallejo. Now, lately, there's been discussion about can states declare bankruptcy. The law does not permit that right now, and I think that would be we would be against that. I understand that some states want to get out of some of their contracts, but the ramifications for the quality of their debt. By the way, California has the worst rating in America. We're lower than Louisiana in terms of our debt rating. It tells you where we are. The consequences of bankruptcy for a state, even if Congress tried to pass it, would be too negative in my view.
Roxanne, should bankruptcy be considered at any level?
No. I mean, I agree with Joe that I think we have to come to the table. We have to find solutions because bankruptcy decimates and destroys the entire community. I mean, it sort of kills everyone, lets God sort them out. And that sort of rash, extreme approach is responsible.
Okay. I have a question I just want to quickly answer, we're not going to get to all the questions, so forgive me. But somebody asked, if a worker is fired, does their pension liability go away? Correct me if I'm wrong, but the answer is no. If they're vested in it, when they're fired.
If they're fired, they don't get a pension.
Pardon?
If they're fired, they do not get a pension.
Yes, they do.
If you're a public employee and you get fired, I mean, being an advocate for BART workers, if you are a public employee and you get fired, you do not receive your pension.
Well, if you're vested up to that point,
you do not. You do not receive your pension. I mean, I'm telling you that because I've witnessed people, men, cry because they were caught using drugs after 15 and 20 years at BART, and they lost everything. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to maintain a good record and the
John,
fear of being
John
fired.
John Joe, are you aware of a situation like that?
I'd be surprised by that. I mean, I used to be a union rep as well, and if somebody on the private sector, if someone was fired, as long as they were vested, they got something.
I'd like to be the lawyer handling that case. I'd make a lot of money.
Well, that's something we'll have to look into and get back to you guys.
Exactly. Okay. So are there other options we need to quickly cover? We have about 5 minutes, and I want to save about two or three of them so you guys can each have a quick last comment. John, yes.
The solution, in our view, is shifting over to defined contribution plans. All defined benefit plans, even with some of the reforms that we've talked about, leave taxpayers at risk. A defined contribution plan, the obligation of the public terminates with every pay period. You contribute into that employee's retirement fund. The obligation of the taxpayers, the obligation of the employer terminates at that point. Everybody has predictability. The problem with defined benefit systems is they're counter-cyclical. And by that I mean when the economy tanks and the investment portfolio shrinks, that's the exact same time that the public treasury shrinks because it's a recession. So there's a bigger demand to replenish the public retirement system at the very same time tax revenues are shrinking to government. So defined benefit is the worst of both worlds because it's a snowball effect.
Take one more minute.
One more minute.
30 more seconds.
Okay. 401k systems do not have to be inherently risky. You can modulate your risk tolerance. Invest in treasuries if you want to preserve your principal. Also, portable for employees. They can take it from one place to another. Really, ultimately, that's going to be the answer in our view.
Roxanne, take about 2 minutes and give me your thoughts on the solution, but just keep it two minutes, please.
I think the future holds. We have to be creative. I think it's going to be a mixture of a lot of things. It's going to be having to take some thought from John and Joe and myself as a worker. I think we are going to have to look at abuses. I think we do have to have transparency. I think politics doesn't belong anywhere where we're looking at the welfare of our communities and of our retirement. Those are the positive things. I think reform has to be broader. I think it has to be national. And I got to tell you, as working people, we're fighting for everybody. It's not just whether you're in a union or not. And I think unions have made big mistakes in the past. And they haven't served us people very well because it's about everybody. And I'm hoping and I'm confident that we have to find the solutions to fix this country.
Joe, just take about a minute and a half and your thoughts on where we need to go.
Well, we've outlined a number of steps here, governance, look at benefits, how funds are invested, and so forth. But I think the first step in this process is, and I hope no one's offended by this analogy, is similar to what an alcoholic goes through, where you have to say, I have a problem. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to. And I'm so glad that Roxanne is here representing public employees, because so many public employee union representatives have said to me, we don't have a problem, there's not an issue, everything is just fine. And despite the growing amount of evidence that suggests that there really is a problem. And so, like that alcoholic, the first thing that the funds and others associated have to do is say, we have a problem. And then you need to, again, sit down and to try to work through a solution of some kind. That's what we really need to do. And so I really applaud you being here. I hope that more public employees and union reps will engage in this to try to find the path out. Because if we don't resolve this, if we don't solve this, It won't just be those pensions that may be at risk because of bankruptcy and so forth. It will be the services that we care about. It'll be libraries, parks, police, fire, commissions, you name it. Everything will be, in my opinion, just decimated because of this avalanche of pension debt that we have.
Folks, I'm sorry we weren't able to get to all the questions. I tried to wrap them into the questioning. There are lots of good questions. I want to very much thank our panelists, John Kupal, president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, Roxanne Sanchez, president of the Service Employees International Union 1021, and Joe Nation, director of the Graduate Public Policy Practicum at Stanford University. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Dan Bornstein, columnist and editorial writer for the Contra Costa Times and Oakland Tribune, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.